Welcome to the Oxford Farming Conference Emerging Leader Podcast in association with BASF. The Oxford Farming Conference, held every January, kickstarts the year with a varied programme of speakers, each selected to inform, challenge and inspire. We're proud to be working with Rock and Roll Farming to bring you a series of podcasts of emerging leaders in the industry who have attended the conference, sharing with you their stories and views. For more information, go to ofc.org.uk.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to the latest Oxford Farming Conference Emerging Leader podcast, brought to you by Rock and Roll Farming in association with BASF. I'm your host, Will Evans, and for this one, I spoke to arable farmer Tim Beaver. We talked about his family farm near Stamford in Lincolnshire and the range of crops they grow there, including malting barley, wheat for biscuits and Weetabix, oilseed rape for biofuel and sugar beet for silver spoon sugar. We also discussed environmental schemes and the positives and negatives, which unfortunately for Tim, like so many others, have left him disillusioned with the countryside stewardship scheme and questioning his further participation. We discussed his time studying agriculture at Newcastle Uni and his time travelling around Australia afterwards, which saw him feature on the front page of a newspaper down there in a good way, happily. And we then got to talk about how, after running the business for a number of years, he gained the confidence to venture off-farm and get involved with boards and organisations, including the NFU Sugar Board and the Red Tractor Crops and Beet Board. We go into his involvement in the BASF Real Results Circle and the enormous amount he's getting out of peer-to-peer knowledge sharing through that, before going on to his recent trip to New Zealand with BASF, which he describes sensationally as better than his honeymoon. And lastly, we talk about his experiences as an Oxford Farming Conference Emerging Leader in 2018. So without further ado, here he is, Tim Beaver. And tonight I'm heading over to Stamford in Lincolnshire to talk to arable farmer Tim Beaver. Tim, how are you?
Hi, Will. Doing very well, thank you. Good to hear from you.
You enjoying a bit of rain at the moment?
We are, yep. Good old arable farmers. We're never too happy, are we? Too wet, too dry. But we've been incredibly dry the last 18 months. So the crops are looking decent at the moment, but we know all the dikes and all the rivers at the moment, they're very empty. So, yep, the rest of the country is miserable on a wet Friday, but farmers are very, very happy. So a wet Friday is always good news.
So tell us about your farm, Tim. What have you got going on over there?
Okay, then. Yep, we're based in South Lincolnshire, outside a little market town called Stamford. So we've got a range of soils that we grow crops of food on. We try to target local markets if possible. So we grow some wheat that goes 10 miles down the road to Weetabix. We grow quite a lot of malting barley, winter and spring, and they go to the brewery towns of Burt upon Trent and Bury St Edmunds. Mm-hmm. And we also grow some sugar beet and oilseed rape. And it works out roughly, we grow 24 million Weetabix, we grow 10 million pints of beer and 700,000 kilograms of sugar. So wow. It puts it in context. So we do the old farming thing. We sell it wholesale and buy it retail, basically. That's a supermarket trolley at the end of the day.
That's really cool how you've worked that out. That's very impressive. So I guess growing crops like that for human consumption, then quality is key for you.
Yeah, it kind of makes us target at the end of it. If we know what market we are, Weetabix are very good. They've got a growers club. We meet it once a year and they ask what specifications they want, what type of wheat they'd ideally want. Mm-hmm. Plus, you've got the low food miles there as well. Same with the beer as well, saying the 10 million pints of beer that we produce between Bury and Burton. It's always good to see when, I think, Carlsberg at the moment use a Red Tractor. Adams are very good as well. So it's nice to know where your products end up at the end of the day. And obviously with sugar beet as well, you've got Silver Spoon Supermarket, a big supporter of the Red Tractor. And again, you've got the rules and stipulations of what goes into the crop. So you know what you're eating at the end of the day and where it's come from.
Absolutely. I think you said there were a mix of winter and spring sown crops. Is that just to spread the workload a bit, or is it about black grass? Bit of both.
Yeah, you can tell you've been talking to lots of arable farms. You're spot on with both. So there's only two of us, and we farm over a range of just over 500 hectares. So 500 fairly sizable rugby pitches, and there's two of us. So we're quite stretched on labour. That's probably the pinch point. So the lack of winter and spring cropping helps spread it.
Now you have a strong technical knowledge, as you can already tell from the interview. You're basis and facts qualified. I guess that's a big advantage for you.
Yeah, I think it's something I really enjoy. I'm the chap who does all the fertilizer spreading and does all the spraying on the crops as well. So when I'm going over the crops, it's useful to know what I'm looking at as well. And especially in the age we live in now, where you can get chemicals from independent supplies when you want to use them. So on that respect, it was really interesting. I did the basis course when I first came back to the farm. It's something I really enjoyed. And then due to me not really doing too much skiing or shooting, which is very rare for an arable farmer, I did an example about once a year for about 7 years to keep me out of trouble. So that was a really good fun. And I ended up with a basis diploma. So, and it's something, I think, once you get your teeth stuck into it, it's quite good fun.
Yeah,
it gives it a different angle to the farm.
Yeah, I'm sure. Are you in any environmental schemes there on the farm?
Yeah, we are, Will. We're totally an arable farm. So our exposure to crops going up and down, the volatility we're seeing, we see the environmental scheme as quite an important diversification for us. So and we've got some great land. We've got farms near the river and woodland, which can go into the scheme. So we entered the ELS, which was the first environmental scheme, and we got on well with that for 10 years. We've entered the new one, the Countryside Stewardship, because the old one finished, and we've had a lot of hassle, to be fair. We've had late payments. We're talking 12, 15 months late payments. And also, we had an investigation in 2017. When I left the farm, I thought the examiner inspector left the farm. I thought everything was okay, a few minor tweaks. But then 13 months later, the fines came through the post. And now I'm trying to prove my innocence from 2017, which is proving quite tricky. So the whole way the scheme's handled is being a bit disappointing. And to be fair, going forward, it might put farmers off going into schemes, which is a shame, because they're there for the of great benefit in theory.
Yeah, well, I was one of the people at the NFE conference furiously writing down Michael Gove's secretary's email address when he gave that out for people who've got any problems. So let me know if you want me to pass that on.
No, I did. It was brilliant when Mr. Gove gave that out, because that's exactly what I did. And we've actually got the bridging payment from I've got our very first payment in 2018 after I sent that email in.
Yeah.
Which was brilliant.
So were you always going to join the family farming business, Tim? Was that what you wanted to do when you grew up?
Yeah, I think so. I like the idea. Certainly, as you well know, it's a great office space to be in, and the chance to be your own boss and actually make a difference, that kind of thing really appealed to me.
Yeah.
I went to Newcastle to do agriculture, but I must admit, in the third year, with the disaster of foot and mouth broke out across the UK. So our lectures broke down from maybe 20 hours a week down to about 5 hours a week. So I ended up doing teaching as part of my degree as well. So I've always had an eye on teaching. I think thinking about it, I think arable farming and teaching, I probably just like my holidays a bit too much. But that was good fun. I went out there in Newcastle and did teaching for quite a few months around there. So that was enjoyable. But I think farming is maybe always where the heart was. So yeah, I was very happy to come back and give it a go.
Yeah, okay. So after university, did you come straight back to the farm, or did you go and do a bit of travelling?
Yeah, like many people, I think after university, I think it was quite good if you had the opportunity to get away and do a bit of work. So it was very lucky. There was a cricket tour around Australia. They call it the Barmy Army, or the England fans.
Yeah.
We went around Australia for 4 months watching England play cricket. And that was something else. It was $3 to the pound. And you could live very well. You could. So that was great fun. Did a bit of work in Australia and then traveled around South America for a few months as well. Came back and then lived up in Edinburgh for a year and did some farm work up there for a year, just because my parents were always very keen for me to almost get away from the farm to want to come back. And then I think when I was about 24, 25, I kind of always knew I wanted to come back here, and I think I was ready as well. I think I'd been out there and got all the partying out of the system, so I was ready to come back and get my teeth stuck into something.
Yeah, and I'm going to take you back to, didn't you end up on the front page of an Australian newspaper dressed as a cricket umpire?
I did, yeah, in a good way as well, before I interject there. It wasn't a bad way, I was a drunken English fan, but yeah, we went down to the MCG, we did on, it was Christmas Day Eve, that was it, because the boxing test in Melbourne was Boxing Day, so and I dressed up as an umpire with another friend for the Barmy Army Tour. We were the two cheating umpires in the 12 Days of Christmas, so we wore these horrible sweaty umpire coats for 4 months going around Australia. So you can imagine it, 40 degree heat. And we had all the England players' signatures on it. And you'd get some nights out with it and wake up with stains on it the next morning. You had no idea about. But anyway, this poor lady, bless her, she took a picture of us. And then Christmas Day in Melbourne, the Melbourne paper, 2002, front cover we were, me and the ever-cheating umpire.
Wow.
So, yeah, there you got some claim to fame.
Fantastic. So, before this interview, you sent me some info about yourself, and you said something really interesting, that you spent 10 years running the business before having enough confidence to know what you were talking about and venture off the farm. That really piqued my interest. Can you expand on that a bit, please?
Yeah, it was very telling listening to yourself and Joe Stanley, your podcast the other day, when Joe kind of went for the same thing. I think when you first come back to the farm, you're key to learn and you go to meetings and you sit there, and I wouldn't dare put my hand up to ask a question because you'd sit there thinking, crikey, everyone here would just laugh at you or think about you don't know what you're saying. So, and then over time, you just learn by doing, you get a bit more confidence that you know what you're talking about. And yeah, we run the farm business for about 10 years. And then by then, you know, you really get the hang of it, especially when you're doing, you know, quite hands-on, you get the hangs of what the problems are, what could be improved, and you go to meetings a bit more confident. But it's quite hard to make that next step almost. You can go to meetings a bit confident and know what you're talking about, but to make that next step and get involved with things is often quite tricky. So I think something that's where something like the Emerging Leaders course that Oxford Farming Conference ran along with BSF, that was brilliant. That's the first time kind of gets you off the farm, kind of gets you to that next stage. And the sugar industry also does the sugar industry program. It was the first commodity to do it, like a young person scheme across the whole commodity. So they take you all the way from the breeding houses in Europe all the way through to the House of Parliament, where they discuss sugar there, and they introduce you to every step along the way. And that kind of bridging gap's brilliant. So it kind of gives you a bit more confidence knowing what you're talking about, and also gives you the contact so you can take it on the next step if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're now on the NFU Sugar Board that's led to that.
Yeah, that's it. I think the whole sugar board now, apart from the chairman, Mr. Slight, we all went through the sugar industry program, which is brilliant because it really gets you, you don't have to, you can take as much or as little as you want from it. But I think at the end of the sugar industry program I did, I was quite keen to get on the board. And we took one person from each year onto the board. Unfortunately, I missed out the first time, which was, in hindsight, you know, like many of these things, quite a good thing. They took on a gentleman called Simon Smith, who's vice chairman now, and he's absolutely brilliant here. So they definitely made the right decision. But then after 6 months, I thought, well, yeah, I still quite fancy this. I still think I know what I'm talking about. I still think I can offer something. So I stood for elections, which the NFU Sugar Board have every year, which is brilliant. Each grower gets one vote, and you know, you can stand for what you believe in, kind of thing. And I was very honoured to get voted onto the board. And it gives you another angle to the farm. It gets you off the farm, and I love sitting in the room with lots of intelligent people, learning off them, and seeing how these boards work. And it's something I really enjoyed. So I'm 3 years into it now and really enjoying it.
Yeah, and you are actually involved in a few other things as well, the Basis Membership Committee, Red Tractor Crops and Beet Board.
Yeah, I'm a bit like a mini you in a way. I think you surprised yourself, you said, about how much you've enjoyed getting up a farm.
Yeah.
These kind of boards and these kind of positions where you probably thought maybe 5 years ago, well, it's not really for me, I want to go and do a bit of farming. But I think when they draw you into these boards, and especially when you find you can make, you know, perhaps I'm too big-headed, but you can make a bit of a difference, you know, as long as the criticism you put forward is constructive or the ideas are positive, kind of thing. I've always said, I don't mind being told I'm wrong, but just tell me why I'm wrong. So I'm happy in meetings just to discuss ideas and discuss problems going forward. And as you say, I think farmers like you, I mean, we're at the coalface a bit. It's quite useful in that perspective that we can put forward what's relevant at the moment and hopefully try to improve. The Red Tractor Board is the Crops and Sugar Beet Board. That's something really close to my heart. I think the Red Tractor as a brand could be really, really strong going forward. I think it probably hasn't turned out like anybody would have ideally liked it. But you talked to Jim Mosley yourself on one of the podcasts, and I think I'm a huge fan of Jim. He's got real energy, real direction. So I'm really hopeful the Red Tractor can turn it around a bit and hopefully get more positive, especially with post-Brexit. I think we're going to need to have something going forward. And the quality of British produce we do and the traceability side of it and also the health side of it, I really hope that that can be something we can use to market.
Yeah, definitely. No, I couldn't agree more. Okay, Tim, so back to actual hands-on farming. Like most arable farmers in the UK, you've embraced modern technology over the years. What sort of things are you doing there to improve efficiencies?
Yeah, it's, I must admit, with me and one other person, we're a bit of a one-man band, so we're slowly, but if it'll pay for itself, we'll use it. So we've used things like variable rate fertilizer for potassium and phosphorus, and we played around with the nitrogen idea as well, because these are very high inputs and they're also very sensitive to water quality, so we're we're willing to give them a go. The nitrogen one we have gone away from at the moment. We haven't seen it could pay for itself at the moment on the short term, and we can still control certainly the environmental side by doing it manually. But the P&K side of it, we're varying the seed rate as well. If you've got a slightly trickier bit of land, the maps, you can feed your field map into a computer before, and it will, as you grow over it, automatically put more seed down there just to try and help that tricky area so you can even up your yields going forward. Auto shut off on sprayers as well, to make sure you're not overlapping with sprayers. So yep, I must admit, we're more the second mouse of the trap kind of thing when it comes to this technology, because we like to see if it's often paid off elsewhere. But certainly going forward, it's very interesting as well. Certainly the seed technology side, Mr. Gove at the Oxford Farming Conference and Energy Conference, he keeps on saying about how he's quite willing to embrace maybe new seed technology kind of thing. And by that, we mean something like CRISPR, isn't it? Something with the seeds, rather than being GM when you're adding something into the DNA of a crop. Rather than, if you can just cut something out, which is a weakness among the plant, which means it will be healthier and we need less crop input, and then surely, hopefully, that should be a good thing and it shouldn't be too controversial. So going forward, that could be really exciting post-Brexit if we're allowed a bit more free rein. You know, we could become world leaders in seed technology, which I find quite exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's easy to get a bit dragged down by the negativity around at the moment, isn't it? But at the same time, it is a very exciting time to be a grower. I mean, there's so many new developments coming in that, I mean, I can't really imagine over the next 20 years, our jobs are going to be so different, aren't they?
Yeah, it's uncertainty, isn't it, at the moment? I'd say it's quite easy to get dragged down at the moment, especially the tariffs. They're talking about dropping more tariffs and food flooding in. They've got to sell a positive side of Brexit, and for some reason they think they can do cheap food, even though, as it's been well publicised, they're the third cheapest food in the world relative to wages. So, yeah, it's going to be tricky. I'm not quite on board as much as maybe other people regarding these robots, especially for arable farming, as much as I hope I'm wrong. I think the small margins you get with arable farming, often over large sizes, I'd be surprised to see if we see that kind of level investment for robots. I think certainly other higher quality and higher margin products could be the first ones to do. But who knows? As you say, hopefully I'm wrong kind of thing. But it is interesting, at least it's been talked about. But whether we'll get there or not in my time, I'm a little bit unsure, I must admit.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about the sugar beet. You were very vocal about the recent neonicotinoid ban. How disappointed were you that it was banned and that other countries are still being able to use it?
Yeah, that's exactly. On a scale of 1 to 10, 11 in disappointment, hugely. There were many reasons you could go into that. Is the neonicotinoids, are they particularly bad? There's very mixed surveys out there and studies being done, but basically sugar beet is a non-flowering crop, so it's not attractive to bees. No. So when you put the sugar beet in the ground, and sugar beets all drilled by precision drills, so you're putting it underneath so there's no exposure to birds, so they can't come along and give it a peck. So you're putting a very small amount of seed coating on this seed, putting it underground, and saying the sugar beet little seed itself, it puts on 30,000 times its own weight in about 8 months, so it really grows rapidly. It does. And the neonicotinoid seed treatment, it runs out after 8 weeks of being on the seed. Actually, the levels in the plant stop. And what this stops is the aphids. These wonderful things, aphids, when they break out in springtime with diseases, they all hop plant to plant and sugar beet, and they spread this disease, this virus. And this neonicotinoid actually just stops the aphid from jumping on again. So it lasts for 8 weeks and then it runs out. So it's very relatively low doses. And the main thing was we had no alternative. It was such an efficient way of doing it. All the crop breeding side of it completely stopped. So when Mr. Gove overnight turned this ban off, we have no alternative. And the rest, the real disappointing thing is European countries have seen this. 11 European countries have overturned this ban. There's only us and France that have stuck by it, because the other countries have listened to the science, listened to the farmers, and said, look, give us 4 years. We can get there with seed technology. Yeah. Give us 3 or 4 years to get there as a bridging gap. And then we'll stop using it. If that's what the public want, then okay. But this is the best current mode of action we've got. And as I say, for 11 countries that we're competing with to grow sugar in Europe have overturned this ban and said, look, you can have it this year as a one-off, but, you know, get your house into order. We would have really appreciated that, because it just leaves us a bit in the lurch and very uncompetitive, which seems a little bit unfair going forward.
Yeah, and
you can probably tell I'm rambling.
No, it also sets quite a worrying precedent as well, doesn't it? Because if they can ban this for such dubious reasons, then they can, you wonder what else they're going to ban, don't you?
You're spot on. Yeah, it's a real worry that they won't listen to science. They're just listening to the loudest noises. And to be fair, these green NGOs, they're very good at what they do.
Exactly.
Their careers depend on it. They need to get money. They need to stir up things every year. And we don't doubt. We desperately want to look after the countryside as farmers for the long term. My whole future depends on a healthy countryside. So the idea that I'm trying to poison the countryside for 1 year's crop is just it wouldn't make sense on any level at all. But not to listen to that science side, yeah, that's probably the real disappointing thing going forward, because you get the impression that, as you say, if they ban that, what's next?
Yeah. And sugar itself, I mean, whenever I see you, you're carrying a bag of Silverspoon sugar with you. You're a very vocal supporter of it. There's lots of talk about sugar in the diet recently in the press. Do you think that it's getting an unfair bad rap, like it's the current bad guy of food?
Yeah, I just spend the bag of sugar. That's probably, when I've seen you at Oxford Farming Conference, we've been there, and I often get quite miffed off when I go to meetings, and we go there and they've never got any British grown sugar.
Yeah.
So whenever we go to Oxford at the moment, I'm always the idiot walking around with a bag of sugar insisting people should have British grown sugar. So that gets that one away. And yeah, and regarding sugar, I think it does, it gets a fair unfair rap at the moment. Don't get me wrong, I think going forward, there is an obesity problem in the country. Mm-hmm. It's just me talking as a farmer or as a consumer. There is a problem with obesity. We know that people's diets need changing. We need more education, I believe, and more exercise on it. I think the whole element of trying to demonize sugar as a single nutrient on its own, I think it's quite worrying. I must admit, I know you've got some daughters, but I've got two daughters growing up, and certainly the body pressures females have in the society, which obviously a far bigger question, but I'd hate my girls to grow up thinking there was one food source they had to really be careful and be scared and watching, unaware of anything else. And I think that's a real disappointing element, that they seem to target this one area at the moment, when it doesn't actually address the education side or the fact that we are doing less exercise as well.
Mm-hmm. It's eating more processed foods, isn't it, really? I mean sugar is a natural thing, as you say, it's grown in the ground with your crop. It's just a matter of a balanced diet, surely, isn't it?
Sure, that was it. Yep, sugar beet thing. We just use a bit of rain and a bit of sunlight, we leave it in the ground. I'm probably giving away my secrets here. Sugar beet, how to grow it. The yields increase. Sugar beet is an incredibly natural produce. It only travels 28 miles from the average field to factory to process in the UK. So it's a real low food margin. It's highly traceable. But, and as you say, these kind of these diet drinks on the market, they've got high artificial sweeteners in, which, If you Google these artificial sweeteners, they're certainly more scary, my angle is, than these natural sugar products. They're very untested about how the human body can actually handle artificial food and highly processed food. So, I think we're the cusp of here, aren't we, of learning just about how our bodies are going into it. But I'd rather, as long as you're aware of what you're eating, and if it's natural, the best you can, then that's my two pence worth. But as you say, I say that as a farmer and a consumer rather than anything else. I see my job to try to produce, a real traceable, real local products and sugar beet. That's my day job.
Yeah. Okay. So how did your involvement in the BASF Real Results Circle come up?
There's a local farmers group, which we meet up. We put the world to right, you know what farmers like when they get together. Needless to say, being arable farmers, we have a nice meal as well. And BASF just helps sponsor that. They come along. I think they pay for one meal, a couple of meals a year kind of thing, and help us out. So that got introduced from there. They just said, look, basically, we're after a bit of a farmers network together. We appreciate some of the trials they see and they do. They're often on very good soils in the middle of a field. What we'd like to do is, just take whole fields and try to learn from the experience of farmers. Does it actually work in practice? So it's worked really well. This is a farmer network. It's all in the social world we live in right now, it's lovely, and don't get me wrong, we can learn things about other farmers, and you learn about farmers' names when you go to meetings. About them already, but the real results actually made a big effort and said, look, we're meeting here on this date, or you're going to use this product versus this product. And with that technology side we were talking about earlier on, we've got very precise yield maps now on a combine. So when we go over these fields, you can tell down to almost a square meter almost of what kind of yield you're coming in from what area. So the chance for BASF to support us with that technical side, and also take pictures throughout the year of green leaf area as the crop's growing. So just try to make us, we're trying to join the dots with arable farming, because the problem is you'd get everything, get all your ducks into line, and then it won't rain for 2 months, and then all your kind of research goes out the window. But what BSF do, they're just trying to help, try to give you just as much information as possible. And I must admit, I love all that. More information, the better. So be it, and they make a really good farming network. There's some real top-notch farmers on there, you know, that when I go and meet them, that the yields they're getting of the land they've got, and it's brilliant. So I go there and I'm basically just trying to harvest information again, trying to get some cheat sheets so I can bring back to my farm. But they just help get that farmer network in place. So it's something I've really, really enjoyed.
Fantastic. Do you think we're getting generally better as an industry at sharing knowledge? It's something that's being focused upon a lot, isn't it? And I think farmer to farmer learning is something that's going to be increasingly important as we go forward, isn't it?
Yeah, I must admit, it's been a bit disappointing, the HDB and the yields increase over the last, you know, the real plateau in yields. We're trying to work out what it is, because it seems to be the varieties every year seem to be slightly improving. Mm-hmm. The chemicals coming through, the pesticides that help control these fungal diseases, they're changing the whole time. So why on-farm yields haven't changed, when especially we've had quite a few recessions within the agriculture industry, which you thought the less efficient growers would have popped out, and yields would have gone up. So I think that there's a real scratch in the head, and I think that's one of the answers people come up with, that more peer-to-peer farmer learning. They're going to trust it a bit more, you're going to get more results from it going forward. So I think post Brexit again, I think it's something I'd certainly be more keen to do, meet up with local farmers in an area, walk in their actual fields and look at the results, opposed to maybe coming to these little trial sites where you know they may have been slightly made to look very pretty and very good, but try to learn a farmer to farmer going forward. So that kind of thing, that's really interesting. And certainly with the ease of technology now, getting in touch with people and taking pictures, you can share that information as well a lot easier.
Of course. So you had a very exciting trip to New Zealand last year for a couple of weeks. How did that come about?
I did. I got a phone call in the middle of harvest saying, do you fancy going to New Zealand for 2 weeks? At which point I thought, crikey, how the heck am I going to sell this to my poor wife? Being an arable farmer, it was perfect time. It was end of November, start of December. BASF ran a competition. Basically, you scanned your cans with a QR code in the springtime, and then you use them on your farm, and you completely forgot about the competition. And then they phoned me up and said, would you fancy a 2-week tour to North and South Island, New Zealand? Wow. New Zealand, for me, wasn't particularly on my radar. It's somewhere where I kind of hope one day I might get to, but you kind of look on a map and think, well, this is a bit far to go. But I must admit, it's been an absolute game changer. I've been looking at New Zealand farms, I'd say almost every night, trying to work out how I could possibly get out there, because it's just incredible. As a country, as people, as scenery, as soil, everything there was just—it's off the scale. If anyone ever gets a chance to get out there, just take it, because it's not easy to get to. But it's certainly somewhere I'm really looking forward to taking the family out there in a couple of years' time, maybe a camper van, and living out there for a month or so, because I think they'll just get so much out of it. It's just a great country.
Absolutely, it's a brilliant outdoors country, isn't it? Great place for families.
Oh, the scenery and the crops, the soils they've got there, and saying BASF were brilliant. They showed us everything possible there. We saw some amazing kiwi farms. We saw some amazing orchards. Some places where they made the grapes, they were very nice as well. And then we also got to see some real world-leading farms as well. Some of the guys won the wheat yield competitions in the world, the highest wheat yields. Mike Solari went to his farm. He's won it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Craig Whiteside, Blair Drysdale, these kind of guy farmers. They were brilliant. And they just, their attitude was brilliant. They took time out of their day. They rocked it up. It showed us, it's a bit like the Real Results Trials New Zealand style. We walked around their fields and they were so open about what they do and just so personable. And I think that every single farmer either gave us a cup of tea or a beer while we were there, which just showed their attitude. They were brilliant and they took time out, and it was, I got told off for saying it's more fun than my honeymoon, the trip was, but I stand by it.
That is a big call.
I pay for it a few times, but I'm standing by it. It was a trip of a lifetime. So,
I guess going there for so long, and you must have learned a lot. But what are the biggest things you learned there? And was there anything in particular that really surprised you?
Oh, cracky. Well, it's how long have you got? I mean, yeah. My wife actually made a noise. Every time I talked about New Zealand, she made a beeping noise. Because after the first week I came back, and that's all I ever talked about. So as soon as I started talking about New Zealand, she just made a beeping noise, which basically meant be quiet, move the conversation on. But yeah, where can you start? They were. I didn't quite realise how reliant they maybe were on the UK market until we joined the EEC, the whole Commonwealth angle. I never quite realised as soon as we joined the European Union, it realized quite overnight how much we switched the tap off. So that was a huge export market for them. Gone for, they really had to, and then the subsidies went around the same time. So they really had to develop because they had these soils and they know they couldn't produce stuff here. But they've gone for the real top end, real high quality produce, which they produce incredibly well. And they found that the local markets grow, certainly in Southeast Asia and China. The dairy side of New Zealand now, they export, I think it's £14 billion worth of dairy products to the Chinese.
Yeah.
To put that in perspective, I think wine and kiwi fruit is about 1.7.
Mm.
So they've got 10 times the amount of dairy produce because China's really keen to get a real high-quality dairy product for their nation. And they've obviously had food scares in China with regard to the milk. So they've really been focused on that. And that's what's keeping up the New Zealand dairy sector at the moment, and the arable sector as well, because everything's going into dairy, into China, but also that the high quality of their produce is just it's brilliant, because all around the world they aim for the top markets and they get a premium. The Japanese market are very keen on them as well, so they can grow it there. And as you say, the soils they have out there are these lovely volcanic soils that have never been farmed on particularly. And I went out there with pen in hand thinking, crikey, I'm gonna really learn something here. And one of the farmers we went and saw, he told us he spreads his wheat on with a fertilizer spinner at 80 kilograms a hectare. Everyone was looking around, obviously, if he's just taking the mickey out of, because in perspective, in the UK, we're putting three times the rate on, and we're putting it on with drills and everything else. The idea of tickling it on the top and then just working it in, and we stood in this guy's field, and you couldn't have got a better crop.
No.
They get results, and they get stuff done. So we looked around, and you couldn't have had a better crop possible. And for the guy to say he just, very lackadaisically span it on with his first spin, we were very envious. But again, it kind of sums up their attitude, because maybe they haven't got to be quite as intensive. And they get every day we're out there, almost they've got a little bit of rain, so every time they put a crop input on, like some fertilizer, it gets nicely washed in, and the crops they never stop growing. So yeah, it was a real honor to stand in their fields and really honor to have their time. Say It was something else. It was to be seen. And just their lifestyle out there, the lack of people out there and the scenery. Yeah, it was one heck of a trip.
Okay, so all about the Oxford Farming Conference, Tim. That's where we met last year on the Emerging Leader Programme, as you mentioned earlier. What did you get out of that?
It kind of got you off the farm. It went to something. I've always looked at the Oxford Farming Conference maybe and looked at the nice pictures that they have of their meals and thought, well, I'm sure it'd be a nice jolly to go to. But and to actually get the chance to go there, we were a little bit, I wouldn't say nervous, but a bit apprehensive. Because we were fairly, it's always nice to be in the farming community because you always feel very young, despite being in, let's say, mid to late 30s at the moment. I think every other sector, we seem to be far too old now. I think my international rugby career will never quite take off. But when we went to Oxford, I think you and me were spring chicken. So yeah, it was brilliant to go there, but we weren't too sure what to expect. But the quality of speakers was just incredible. Mm-hmm. And that's what, certainly in that first year, we were just, I remember we had James Wong and Eva Troy-Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And those two speakers, they were just blew us away. And they weren't particularly talking about farming per se, but they were talking about food trends, food health going forward, what the consumer wants at the end of it. And just going back to the New Zealand side, I think that's what the Kiwis are very good on. They start with the consumer saying, well, the consumer wants A, B and C, let's do it. Where maybe in the UK, we're just producing the same stuff on the hope that there will be a market at the end of it, rather than being terribly focused. And there was What Three Words, saying with that kind of technology now for using GPS, and we've used it on the farm quite a lot for drainage and things like that. And we had one of the guys give a talk about who started What Three Words up. We were really looked after, weren't we? I think we have to give a shout out to Caroline Miller, who was our director 2 years ago. She was brilliant. She was putting her arm around us, chatting with us, getting us introduced to other people. And then she was up there giving speeches and toasts and the rest of it. And she was brilliant. Certainly made us feel really at home, I think. So it was, it was a great experience. And then saying you and me and a few others, we went back last year. We went to go support Sarah, who gave a great talk in the Oxford Farming debate.
Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant, wasn't it, to see Sarah?
It certainly was.
One of the emerging leaders.
Yeah.
And she did an absolutely brilliant job as well. So it was brilliant to go back last year. And as I say, I think you don't learn too much maybe from the farming side, but certainly as a business side going there, you certainly learn a fair old bit. And you go home, your mind's absolutely buzzing. And the people you bump into is fascinating as well. I think that first year, I sat down, got chatting to a gentleman, we started talking about sport and everything else. And it turned out it was Stuart Agnew, the UKIP MEP, being an MEP for a long time. He's incredibly charismatic person, yeah. Very funny. And I agree with about 90% what he said, and then it's just the last 10% what you get talk about. You just think he's on another planet. But that was really good fun, and I think Guy Smith got it. And, you know, these kind of things, you never normally get a chance to rub shoulders with these kind of type of people.
Exactly.
And this year, it was Sir Lockwood Smith, the New Zealand MEP and father of the House. So he was there with his little Kiwi firm, John, and I got chatting to him. And I completely mistook him. This is a farmer from New Zealand, from the Northern Ireland, so... I was incredibly keen to talk about New Zealand, to be honest. I was laughing away from about New Zealand, about what I'd learned, about what I thought about this country, and he was ever so polite talking, and there's a few things we disagreed on. I was like, well, with the greatest respect, I was there only 2 months ago, and it was only when Sir Peter Kendall came and started chatting to us, I suddenly realised he's probably not here, Peter Kendall, to talk to me, so I realised this other gentleman must be very important. So, and then the next day we saw him up on stage give a talk, and he was fascinating, again, he just summed up, I think, the New Zealand side of it, incredibly intelligent, well-spoken, incredibly focused, and it just made me like New Zealand even more, if it wasn't possible.
And also, you ended up, after going to Oxford, running a marathon on the back of it, after listening to Tim Papworth.
One of the things from Oxford, it was to inspire, and on the first conference we went to, it was Tim Papworth. He gave a health and safety speech, and normally they're a little bit dry health and safety. We all know the health and safety, what we should be doing, but we all know as well when you're busy and it just takes a second. But he stood up there, and his first part of his speech was, he lifted up a box and he said, I've got a bit of skull of my skull in the box. And basically it turned out he'd fallen off a ladder, you know, just changing a light bulb. And then before he knew it, intensive care and coma. But it was also, he gave a really good story about how his recovery and about how it affected the people around him. And it really kind of hit home quite hard for me. And at the time, I dare say, being an arable farmer, winter time, I was eating far too much food. So I thought, I could do a marathon. You know, it can't be too hard. So it's a marathon in 5 months. So that was this time last year. And it was, it was intense going, isn't it? I know it takes every life. I know you're in training for the London at the moment, aren't you?
I am, yes. Yeah, absolute misery.
it just takes over your life. Last night I had a curry and a couple of beers and watched it. Now I remember back to last year when you really had to watch everything you ate and long weekend runs.
That's
and,
right.
But in saying that, I know you're doing it for great charity. You're doing it for
Farm Africa.
Farm Africa, that's it. So if anybody hasn't been on your web page, certainly get on there and give you a bit of sponsors. I know how hard they can be, and it's a great reason for doing it. That's the charity side of it. You keep your finger back in it and going, actually, you know, it's worth it.
I'd love
to do it for the local air ambulance, and that really helped. It sounds cheesy, but it really does help.
Of course.
And I say, you get a nice meal at the end of it, and you can eat whatever you want afterwards as well, which is good fun. So, I've done the marathon. I think London, I did actually enter the ballot this year, just on the off chance kind of thing, and I was quite relieved when it came through saying you haven't got it in this year.
So,
it was good fun. And I say, it's funny how these things lead, aren't they, from Oxford and the rest of it. And I'm still running now. I find it a great way to sometimes switch off and work. I'll still go for a half an hour run here or there, kind of thing, once, twice a week if I can. I listen to a few podcasts along the way. It's always a good way to relax.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right, Tim, thank you very much for speaking to us today. It's been really, really good to hear about your life and your experiences.
No, it's been a pleasure, Will.
Cheers, Tim. Hopefully see you soon. That's the end of this Oxford Farming Conference Emerging Leader podcast in association with Rock and Roll Farming, and brought to you by BASF. If you weren't able to make this year's conference, do check out ofc.org.uk, see some of the videos of this year's speakers and many highlights there were. Once again, I cannot stress how highly I recommend going along. It's not only extremely informative, it's heaps of fun, as Tim said, and you will meet all sorts of cool and interesting people there. Hopefully see you there in January 2020.
For news, blogs and more information on the Oxford Farming Conference and its Emerging Leader Programme, go to ofc.org.uk.